Hitler's War by David Irving. We must destroy them too. It's the chapter title. An icy winter descended on Germany. The canals froze, the railways were clogged with military movements, population and industry alike were starved for coal and the most elementary or daily requisites. Day and night, Hitler talked and dreamed of yellow. By Christmas 1939, he had already decided where the big hole was to be punched through the French defenses, at Sedan. And it was indeed at Sedan that the foundations of the Nazi triumph over France were laid. It was now January 1940, and the Führer was back at his chancellery in Berlin. The frightened letter Mussolini had written proved how little Hitler could rely on Italy. It was indeed a curious alliance, for the Forschungsamt now intercepted a coded telegram in which the Belgian ambassador in Rome reported to his foreign ministry in Brussels that Count Ciano had betrayed to him Germany's firm intention of attacking Belgium, and had revealed the date currently set for that adventure. "The Italians are strange people," wrote Wiesacker, "loyal glances toward us so as to share in any successes we may achieve, and gifts and minor acts of treachery for the West, so as to keep in their good books, too." Not surprisingly, Belgium had shifted her main defensive effort to her frontier with Germany. A secret report submitted by German Army Intelligence in January 1940 revealed that since mid-October, two-thirds of all Belgium's forces were massed in the east. With the exception of one division, every single mechanized infantry, armored, and cavalry division is standing on the Belgian frontier. The Belgian gendarmerie, I don't know what the word is. I've never said it before, had received instructions to speed in any French invasion of the country, and while signposts in western Belgium had been replenished and improved to that end, those in the east had been wholly removed to hamper a German invasion. Mayors of Ardennes villages were ordered to prepare billets for the French troops. Mufti-dressed French soldiers were observed on the Belgian transport systems. The fortifications at Liège and on the Albert Canal were far beyond the Belgian military capacity to defend. They had clearly been designed to accommodate French and British troops as well. British bombers regularly trampled through Belgian airspace. In short, Hitler saw no reason to have compunctions about attacking this little neutral. He still frowned on the notion that he had unleashed a world war. For more general consumption, he decided that the best overall title was the Great German War of Liberation. On January 10th, he discussed Operation Yellow with his commanders-in-chief. The weather report was excellent. He decided Yellow would begin on the 17th. As January 10th ended, Germany was closer to launching Yellow than ever before. 2 million men waited, confronting the armies of France, Belgium, and Holland. Shortly before noon the next day, however, infuriating news reached the Chancellery. A Luftwaffe major had strayed in a light aircraft across the Belgian frontier. Hitler stormed into Jodl's room and demanded a complete list of all the documents the major had been carrying. "It is things like this that can lose us the war," he exclaimed in an outburst of startling frankness when spoken by the Führer. Even now, Hitler did not waver on his decision to launch Yellow on the 17th at 3:15 p.m. He confirmed this. One Belgian newspaper reported that the German major had hurled the documents into a stove in the room where he was being interrogated, but a Belgian officer had thrust his hand into the stove and retrieved the smoldering fragments. On January 12th, the attaché in Brussels cabled that the major and his pilot had assured him they had burned all the papers apart from an unimportant residue, and he repeated this in person to Hitler at the Chancellery at 11 a.m. on the 13th. I don't know how true that would be. The guy would probably be killed if he hadn't. The incident was not enough to deter Hitler from launching Yellow, but shortly afterward a bad weather report unsettled him, and at about 1 o'clock that afternoon he ordered all movements stopped. Yellow was provisionally postponed by 3 days, but the weather picture worsened. Hitler told his staff, "If we cannot count on at least 8 days of fine and clear weather, then we will call it off until the spring," and on the afternoon of the 16th he directed that the whole offensive was to be dismantled until then. Hitler left Göring in no uncertainty about his anger at the Luftwaffe's loose security regulations, for 2 more incidents had occurred. Göring reacted characteristically. He dismissed both General Helmuth Felmy, the major's superior, and Felmy's chief of staff, and then calmly informed Hitler that he had consulted a clairvoyant who had who had also reassured him that the most important papers had been destroyed. The intelligence reports from Belgium gave this lie. The Belgian general staff ordered military units in southern Belgium to offer no resistance whatsoever to any French and British troops that might march in. Thanks to the Forschungsamt, Hitler had by now also read the telegram sent by the Belgian military attaché in Berlin, Colonel Goethals, on the evening of January 13th, warning that the German invasion was due the next day, according to what an informateur sincère had told him. Goethals' source was his Dutch colleague, Major G. J. Sass. Sass's source was the German traitor Colonel Hans Oster. By the morning of the 17th, it was clear from the official demarque of the Belgian government that the documents had in fact betrayed most of Yellow in its original form. In a sense, Hitler must have been relieved that this bêtise had forced a major decision on him. Besides, the enemy would now surely concentrate his best forces in the north. The prospects of an encirclement operation beginning at Sedan and ending at the Channel coast were much enhanced. Everything depended on keeping this, his real intent, concealed from the enemy, and in a series of conferences at the end of January 1940, Hitler impressed this on his army commanders. As he said on the 20th, he was convinced that Germany would win the war, but we are bound to lose it if we cannot learn how to keep our mouths shut. When Yellow began, a foreign ministry official would be sent secretly to The Hague to invite the Dutch monarchy to accept the Wehrmacht's armed defense of Dutch neutrality. And there's an asterisk, so let's check it out. Major Werner Kiewitz, who had carried Hitler's first surrender ultimatum to Warsaw on September 16th, was selected for this mission. In the event the Dutch refused to issue any entry visa to him, a desperate plan to parachute him into The Hague was abandoned, as by that time the Queen had escaped to England. Where's that asterisk? Aha. Meanwhile, a constant state of alert was to be maintained in the West on the assumption that Yellow might start at any moment. At the end of January 1940, the Führer had sent his chief military adjutant on a flying tour of the Western Front. On his return to Berlin on February 1st, Colonel Schmundt returned, bursting to report that what he had found at General von Rundstedt's Army Group headquarters at Koblenz. Rundstedt's former chief of staff, General Erich von Manstein, was adamantly opposed to the current War Department OKH offensive plan in the West, as was Hitler. Moreover, he was advocating a radical alternative almost identical to what Hitler had been debating with his closest staff ever since October. This convinced Hitler of its soundness, and that the OKH bureaucrats had removed Manstein from his post with Rundstedt and given him command of a corps in their rear impressed him even more. I hope you guys understood that. I wasn't really paying attention. On February 13th, Hitler told Jodl of his decision to commit the mass of his armor to the breakthrough at Sedan, where the enemy would now at least expect it. Jodl urged caution. The gods of war might yet catch them napping there, for the French might launch a powerful flank attack. But now Hitler was deaf to criticism. On the 17th, he buttonholed Manstein in person when the general attended a chancellery dinner party for the new corps commanders. Manstein assured him that the new plan was the only means by which to obtain total victory on land. The next day, Hitler sent for General von Brauchitsch and his chief of staff and dictated the new operational plan to them. On February 24th, the War Department issued the new directive for Yellow. The subsequent outstanding success of the new strategy convinced Hitler of his own military genius. Henceforth, he readily mistook his astounding intuitive grasp for the sound logical planning ability of a real warlord. His reluctance to heed his professional advisors was ever after magnified. To undermine the French soldiers' morale, Hitler ordered German propaganda to hint the real quarrel was with the British. But Hitler's true attitude toward Britain was a maudlin, unrequited affection that caused him to pull his punches throughout 1940. As Haller explained, Hitler's program to the chief of army intelligence late in January, "The Führer wants to defeat France, then a grand gesture to Britain. He recognizes the need for the empire." During lunch at the Chancellery in the weeks of early 1940, Rudolf Hess once inquired, "Mein Führer, are your views about the British still the same?" Hitler gloomily sighed, "If only the British knew how little I ask of them." How he liked to leaf through the society pages of the Tatler, studying the British aristocracy in their natural habitat. Once he was overheard to say, "Those are valuable specimens. Those are the ones I'm going to make peace with." The Chancellery dinner attended by Manstein and other corps commanders fell on the day after the Altmark incident, in which the Royal Navy had violated Norwegian neutral waters under circumstances to be explained below. Hitler expounded loudly on the inherent properness of such actions, whatever the international lawyers might subsequently proclaim. History, he once more explained, judged only between success and failure. Wait a minute. Oops. Give me a second. Okay. That was all that really counted. Nobody asked the victor whether he was in the right or the wrong. Since the action off the Uruguayan coast, the supply ship Altmark had lain low, her holds packed with 300 British seamen captured from Graf Spee's victims. Until mid-February 1940, the worried German Admiralty had heard no sound from her, but on the 14th, she signaled that she was about to enter northern Norwegian waters. Under the Hague rules, she was entitled to passage through them, for she was not a man of war, but a naval auxiliary flying the flag of the German merchant marine. The Norwegian picket boats interrogated her and undertook to escort her, but in Berlin, late on the 16th, the Admiralty began intercepting British naval signals, which left no doubt that an attempt was afoot to capture the Altmark, even if it meant violating Norwegian neutral waters. By 6 a.m. the next morning, a radio signal of the British commander to the Admiralty in London had been decoded in Berlin. The British destroyer Cossack had been alongside the Altmark, and he and his group were returning to Rosyth. At midday, a full report was in Hitler's hands, telephoned through by the legation in Oslo. Seeing the British force, a cruiser and six destroyers closing in, the Altmark's captain had sought refuge in Jossing Fjord. Two Norwegian vessels had held the British ships at bay until dusk, when the Cossack had forced her way past them and ordered the German ship to heave to. The Altmark's report described how a boarding party had seized the ship's bridge and began firing blindly like maniacs into the German crew, who of course did not have a gun between them. The 300 prisoners were liberated, the ship and its crew were looted. London had signaled the captain that the destroyers were to open fire on the Norwegian patrol boats if the latter resisted the British approach. The German Naval Staff War Diary concluded, "From the orders of the Admiralty, it is clear beyond peradventure that the operation against the supply vessel Altmark was planned with the deliberate object of capturing the Altmark by whatever means available, or of releasing the prisoners, if necessary, by violating Norway's territorial waters." Hitler thoughtfully ordered that in the ensuing operation to recover the damaged Altmark, Norway's neutrality was to be respected to the utmost. More than the strategic need to occupy the Norwegian coast before the Allies could do so, there began to weigh with Hitler the belated consideration that since the Scandinavian peoples were also of Germanic stock, they naturally belonged within the German fold. It is important to recall that in none of his secret speeches to his generals had Hitler adumbrated, A-D-U-M-B-R-A-T-E-D, never heard that word, the occupation of Scandinavia. None of his secret speeches to generals had Hitler adumbrated the occupation of Scandinavia. Only after Quisling's visits had the Führer ordered Jodl's staff to study such a possibility. The OKW study recommended that a special working staff under a Luftwaffe general should devise a suitable operational plan under the codename Oyster. This staff began work under General Erhard Milch a week later. Almost immediately, however, Hitler ordered the unit dissolved. He was not convinced that the Luftwaffe knew how to safeguard the secrecy of such planning. Instead, a top-secret unit was established under Hitler's personal supervision. Its senior officer was a Navy captain, Theodor Kranke. He proposed simultaneous amphibious landings at 7 Norwegian ports: Oslo, Kristiansand, Arendal, Stavanger, Bergen, Trondheim, and Narvik. The troops began being carried northward by a fleet of fast warships. Paratroops of the 7th Air Division would support the invasion. Diplomatic pressure on the Oslo government would do the rest. Characteristically, Hitler consulted neither Brauchitsch nor Goering at this stage. Piqued by this, Goering refused to attach a Luftwaffe officer to Kranke's staff. Hitler, meanwhile, put the campaign preparations in the hands of an infantry general, Nicholas von Falkenhorst. Falkenhorst accepted the mission with alacrity and returned to the Chancellery on the 29th with a complete operational plan which now embraced Denmark as well. On March 1st, Hitler signed the directive Veserbung. The army at once protested at this introduction of a new theater. Goering stormed into the Chancellery and refused to subordinate his squadrons to Falkenhorst's command. Only the Navy committed itself body and soul to the campaign. Hitler wanted the campaign launched soon, before the British and French could beat him to it. Hill brought him telegram after telegram from Helsinki, Trondheim, and Oslo hinting at Allied preparations to land in Scandinavia on the pretext of helping Finland, which had in the meantime been attacked by the Soviet Union. Hitler orally ordered the service commands to speed up their planning. Goering was still discontented, and when Falkenhorst reported progress on March 5th, he expressed loud contempt for all the Army's joint planning work so far. The risk of an Allied intervention in Scandinavia was too great. Through Rosenberg, Hitler received from Kuzling's men in Oslo urgent proof that the British and French invasion plans were far advanced. At lunch on the 6th, Hitler leaned over Rosenberg and said, "I read your note. Things are looking bad." The crisis reached its blackest point on March 12th. A torrent of dispatches from Moscow and Helsinki revealed that armistice talks had begun. London began frantic attempts to keep the Finnish war alive a few more days. Winston Churchill flew in person to Paris on the 11th to inform the French government that his expeditionary force was to sail for Narvik on March 15th at 3:30 p.m. on the 12th. Hitler's Forschungsamt intercepted an urgent telephone call from the Finnish envoy in Paris to his foreign ministry in Helsinki, reporting that Churchill and Daladier had promised him that if the Finns would appeal for help at once, British and French troops would land in Norway. That really put the fat on the fire. Hitler ordered all German invasion plans accelerated, and the forces to stand by for the so-called immediate op, emergency. By the next morning, however, the Russians had signed an armistice with Finland, and this immediate crisis was over. The German Admiralty's intercepts of coded British radio messages clearly indicated to Hitler that the British and French had been on the brink of landing in Norway. The fact that their troop transports were still on extended sailing alert proved, however, that the Allies had only postponed their invasion. German invasion preparations returned to a more leisurely pace. For the time being, Hitler withheld the executive order for the operation. "He is still searching for a sufficient reason," Jodl wrote in his diary. We have seen how Hitler concerned himself, however, not only with grand strategy, but with the most minute interlocking elements of each operation. The position of the demolition charges on canal bridges, the thickness of the concrete in his fortifications, the caliber of guns commanding the Norwegian fjords. In this he was aided by a phenomenal memory and technical insight into weapons design. On his bedside table lay the latest edition of Wehr's Taschenbuch der Kriegsflotten, a naval handbook like Jane's Fighting Ships, for the Führer to commit to memory as though he were preparing for some astounding music hall act. It was he who first demanded that 75mm long barrel guns be installed on German tanks, and it was he who pinpointed one common error in German warship design, building the forecastle so low that in heavy seas it tended to cut beneath the waves. On his birthday in 1937, the proud Navy had presented him with a model of Scharnhorst, Late that evening, he had sent for his adjutant, Putcommer, and invited him to crouch and squint along the model's decks with him. He was right, of course, and even at that late stage, the forecastle had to be redesigned. When the Red Book of Arms production reached him each month, he would take a scrap of paper and, using a colored pencil, scribble down a few random figures as he ran his eyes over the columns. He would throw away the paper, but the figures remained indelibly in his memory, column by column, year after year, to confound more fallible aides with the proof of their own shortcomings. Once late in 1940, Keitel presented the figures on the total ammunition expended in the recent French campaign, but Hitler responded that in 1916, the German armies had consumed far more 210mm and 150mm ammunition each month, and he stated the precise quantities from memory. Afterward, Keitel warily instructed his adjutant to forward those new figures to the OKW's munitions procurement office. That is the new program. If the Fuhrer says it, you can take it that it is right. Although the OKW maintained its own munitions procurement office under General George Thomas, Keitel readily echoed Hitler's mounting criticism of the arms production effort during the winter. In vain, Keitel warned that huge production figures could not be attained if the high quality of modern ammunition was not to be jeopardized. Hitler himself drew up a new production program in which priority was given to mine production for the naval and Luftwaffe blockade of Britain, and to huge monthly outputs of artillery ammunition. Keitel issued the program to the Army Ordnance Office, headed by a 60-year-old professor, General Karl Becker. By mid-January 1940, the latter had objected that Hitler's program could not be met to the remotest extent. Hitler was already toying with the idea, first put to him by Goering, who lost no opportunity to criticize the Army's feeble ordnance office, of appointing a civilian munitions minister to take arms and munitions production out of the hands of bureaucratic Army staff officers. When in February the Army Ordnance Office reported the previous month's production figures, Hitler found this the last straw. Production of the most important weapons had actually declined. In the two main calibers of shell, the Fuhrer's program figures would not be reached by even April. At the end of February, Goering appointed Dr. Fritztot as a special troubleshooter to locate the bottlenecks in the munitions industry and recommend ways of stepping up production. Tot convinced Hitler that if the industry was given the system of self-responsibility that had functioned so well in the construction of the Autobahns and of the West Wall, Hitler's impossible, in quotations, production figures could be achieved. Oh, like a free market, sort of? In March, Hitler appointed Tot to his munitions minister. It was as much a rebuff to Keitel as to General Becker, who sensed his disgrace keenly and committed suicide not long after. The first of a sorry band of such German generals whose only common denominator was a failure to come up to Hitler's expectations. On March 1st, 1940, Hitler had secretly summoned the party's Gauleiters to the Chancellery and blamed the weather for their lack of action in the West. He assured them the war would be over in 6 months. His new weapons would force the enemy to their knees Without doubt, he was alluding to the mass mine-laying operations of the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe was shortly to begin, using the magnetic mine against which he believed the Allies had no defense. "The Fuhrer is a genius," recorded Goebbels afterwards. He says that a lot. "He's going to build the first Germanic people's empire." He's a great propaganda minister. Italy's uncertain stance continued to trouble Hitler. Roosevelt sent his Under Secretary of State, Sumner Wells, to sound the engaged European capitals on the prospects of peace. Hitler studied the Italian communique on Wells' Rome talks and compared them with the Forschungsamt intercepts of the secret Italian dispatches. In his own talks with the American, he adhered rigidly to his argument that since this was Britain's war, it was up to Britain to end it. On March 4th, Hitler repeated that to a General Motors Vice President James D. Mooney. "The current war can only be brought to an end by the other countries giving up their war aims," meaning the annihilation of Germany. Germany, he said, had no war aims. Britain's heavy-handed dealings with Mussolini reinforced Hitler's Axis position. To force Mussolini to take his trade negotiations with Britain seriously, the British imposed a naval blockade on Italy's coal supplies at the beginning of March. Hitler stepped in with an immediate offer of 1 million tons of coal a month. He instructed Jodl's staff to provide him with a folder of charts, including one grossly faking Germany's actual military strength, crediting her with 207 divisions instead of her actual 157, and met Mussolini at the Brenner Pass on March 18th. It was their first encounter since Munich. Mussolini arrived with the air of a schoolboy who had not done his homework, as Hitler later put it. The Führer impressed upon him that the Duce could decide the best moment to declare war, but that he, Hitler, would recommend doing so only after the first big German offensive. The Duce promised to lose no time, but admitted that he would prefer yellow to be delayed for 3 or 4 months, until Italy was properly prepared. Hitler hugely exaggerated Germany's prospects. Her armies were more powerful than in 1914, she had more ammunition than she could use, production of Junkers 88 aircraft and submarines was surging forward. As for the British, once France had been subdued, Britain would come to terms with Hitler. "The British are extraordinarily determined in defense," he said, "but quite hopeless at attacking, and their leadership is poor." Despite all his protestations, however, Hitler still mistrusted the Italians, for he imparted to Mussolini neither the impressive operational plan that he and Manstein had evolved for victory in the West, nor even the barest hint at his intentions in Scandinavia. In the directive he soon after issued to Keitel, instructing the Wehrmacht to resume staff talks with Italy, he stated explicitly that any Italian forces must be assigned a task as independent from the main German operations as possible, to minimize the problems inevitable in a coalition war. Hitler attempted in his private talk with Mussolini to convince him that Russia was changed, though how far these words were intended for Soviet consumption is a matter of speculation. He reminded Mussolini that he had always wanted to march side by side with the British, but Britain, he said, prefers war. There were less abstract reasons for his insistence that German industry deliver the goods to Stalin. So long as their pact was in force, it released 60 high-grade divisions for Hitler to employ in the attack on France. His innermost intentions, the Black Nugget, lay never far beneath the surface. Perhaps the Russians could have guessed at them, for in 1940 a new reprint of Mein Kampf went on sale, in which Chapter 14, with its clear statement of his plan to invade the East, remained unexpunged. In conversation with Mussolini, Hitler touched on the enforced evacuation of the German-speaking population of the South Tyrol. He cryptically explained that he planned to resettle those people in a beautiful region that I do not yet have, but will certainly be procuring. He must have already been looking ahead to the day when his armies would be standing astride the Crimea. On March 22, 1940, Adolf Hitler again headed south, flying to the Berghof for the Easter weekend. Captain Engel took the opportunity of this long flight to hand them a report General Guderian had compiled on the training standards of the Soviet troops in Finland. Hitler returned it with the laconic commentary, "Auch die müssen wir vernichten." We must destroy them too. And that's the end of that chapter. Maybe I'll read another one, even though I kind of stayed up late.